This week on the show, it's a conversation with NASCAR legend, motorsport legend, really, Jimmy Johnson. We'll be talking to him. That's all we're doing this week.
There's literally no news.
Nothing's happening. Welcome back to the show, everybody. This is The Big Three. My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm joined, as always, by Joe Weber.
Hello, me. It's me again.
Meet the real me. That was, like, I think the first Megadeth song I ever heard.
Me too. Yeah. I remember the music video was inside, like, an insane asylum. And he's like, it's all, like, shaky camera. It's all twisted. And yeah.
And Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, guys. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I love how you have a hand gesture for an audio format.
Okay.
How was your guys?
We're recording it.
Yeah, a
video.
Sure. Video too. There's video evidence of the little.
Do you want? So moving forward, you would want me to, like?
I want more hand gestures.
Should I narrate my hand gestures?
Yes.
Just say, "Hey guys, thanks for having me. Salute."
Yep.
Yeah. Salute. Yeah.
Salute.
Oh, it's good to be here. Hand wave.
How was your guys' weekend?
It was great. Made some mint juleps, smoked some ribs for the derby.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Did you wear a big hat?
No, the women wear hats.
Oh, wow.
Well, did you wear
just
a suit?
The tradition. What is funny is I was gonna do a bow tie, but I couldn't button the collar. I was like, I don't think my neck's fatter, so hopefully the shirt shrunk.
That's what I tell myself. I'm like, oh, we must have dried it.
Everything else fit. It's not it didn't fit in my shirt. It was just like.
I hate that. Can I talk about the video?
Yeah, Joe. What?
So on Friday, I had my laptop open. I was like, okay, it's just another day of work. And then I hear a knock on my door at like 9:30 in the morning.
At your house.
Tristan and our director, Phil, show up at the door and they're like, put your laptop down. We got stuff to do. And I was like, I got stuff to do on my laptop. And so they're like, Audrey's doing it. Don't worry. And they surprised me with a chance to fix up my Z. My Z31.
Then they flipped a coin and he guessed wrong. So they're not going to fix it.
Yeah. No, but they were like, we're going to do this and this and this and this. And I was like, today? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, we're going to get one of those things done, maybe. And it was really cool of them to surprise me. And I'm really excited for this whole week of working on my Z.
We got some more surprises for you, Joe.
Yeah. I'm like trying to tamp down my excitement a little
bit. Tamp them down. Keep them in a box.
Sure.
Yeah. Like. We don't have any, we're not going to engine swap it or anything.
No, I know. And I learned that pretty quick because they were like, what are your dreams for this car? And I was like, RB swap it, VQ swap it, whatever. And they're like, all right,
what are your daydreams for this car?
And so I was like, okay, I want to do wheels, suspension. They're like, bingo.
Oh, thank God. Because that's what we got.
But so they were like, today we're going to do spark plugs, clean the engine bay. We're going to fix the brakes. We're going to clean the underside. And I was like, I don't know if you understand how complicated.
Clean the underside?
We did that.
Oh,
We clean the underside just because Tristan was like, Tristan's very meticulous about everything.
You're supposed to do that in the shower too, Nolan.
Don't worry about that, buddy.
You seem so surprised to hear. Clean the underside.
Yeah.
Well, I thought they meant like dry ice blasting.
There are a lot of guys there are a lot of guys that don't wash their legs when they take a shower.
You got to wash everything, folks. You don't want MRSA. You don't want cysts. You don't want just clean up, you know? Just clean up.
But anyways, wrapping up the thoughts on the Z. We got to what ended up happening was because it's a 41-year-old car. We're going to do the brakes and the engine bay and the spark plugs. And we only got to two of the four brakes because the pistons on the caliper, both of them were seized in the rear. So,
okay. So that's good that we caught that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we did install braided steel brake lines.
Very cool.
All around. And we're going to do the rest of the brakes today. And I don't know what from there. You guys are keeping me in the dark.
You will find out, as will the rest of the audience, in a couple weeks when that video comes out. Keep an eye out for Joe Z on the Donut Main channel. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm so excited you guys surprised me with that, too.
I'm glad that it was a surprise.
I will say, so I've been thinking about buying a car, and I've been talking to people at lunch about it. And people with 5-6 cars are telling me not to buy this other car. And I'm like, why do you guys have a problem with that? Now it makes sense.
I did realize that, by the way. I was like, I have 4 cars.
Yeah. Why is Jimmy telling me not to buy a third car?
Yeah. Anyway, that'll be a really fun project this week that we're going to undertake. As for me, I was out at Texas Motor Speedway for the Worth 400 Cup Series race. It was a lot of fun.
Did you get your dollars worth?
I did. Even though it was paid for. Or NASCAR sponsored a video of ours due to come out, so we were shooting out there for that. But yeah, it was super cool. We also did a Real Mechanic Stuff episode with Joey Logano. That was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that one. It was just a great time, and we stayed for the Xfinity race, watched that on Saturday night. That was a lot of fun, dude. Kyle Larson was racing. So Kyle Larson, one of the top drivers in the Cup Series, you know, doing a little side quest in Xfinity, where that's like a series for up-and-coming drivers.
Yeah.
Drivers with not a lot of experience. And Kyle was just like, halfway through the race, his pit crew kind of like messed up their pit stop. So he went from like 10th place. He was like working his way up from nearly the back of the pack. 10th place. And then pit crew messes up. So he's like near the back of the pack again. And then you just see him every lap. He's like passing one person.
Oh my God.
And then he won at the end of the race. It was super sick. It was like an overtime finish. Kyle's like sending super gnarly passes around the outside at Texas, which is not easy because that lane up top is like really sketchy. It was just so cool to watch.
Marbles.
And then we had a similar finish on Sunday with event with Joey Logano taking the win with some overtime. It was really fun, man. I'm really looking forward. Hopefully we can go out to Sonoma or even another, like a short track race would be cool too.
If this talk of NASCAR isn't enough for you,
yeah,
and you want more NASCAR talk,
you
came to the right episode.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, just don't press pause.
Yes, it's very apropos, the NASCAR talk, because we got Jimmy Johnson on the show. Let's get
thumbs
to
up
it.
Motion.
Okay, guys, this is insane. Please welcome to the show 7-time NASCAR Cup champion, Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy, thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for being
here. Round of applause and all. I'll take it.
Yeah.
We're all pretty excited.
Yeah. Pretty amazing stuff. I guess right off the top, we'll talk about you have a new podcast on Sirius XM with co-host Marty Smith. It's called Never Settle. Can you tell us a little bit about the show?
Definitely. Have you guys had a chance to meet Marty yet?
No,
not yet.
I haven't.
No. Gosh, I hope you get a chance to. Just a great human, and has certainly had a lot of success within the world of sports. We met 25 years ago or something when he was writing for his local paper in Virginia. And it's funny because I was supposed to, we're at the awards banquet in Beverly Hills for the Busch Series, which is our junior division in NASCAR. And I go out and have this big night with this guy, and he's Marty and I'm Jimmy. And before we go to bed, he's like, yeah, man, I got some work early in the morning. I'm like, yeah, gosh, I have this interview I've got to do. It's gonna suck, man. I'm not looking forward to it. I walk in this room at like 8 in the morning, and I see Marty, and I'm like, oh, man. Oh,
that's
during the interview, he's like, go to bed. We'll find each other later. Don't stress. So
that's pretty funny.
Just a great dude. And again, he's had great success in the media space, and we've always wanted to have a show and put our heads together. And the great people at Sirius have provided us this opportunity. And the crux of our show, one, we kind of share his week and my week, because both very different lives. You know, the show lives on the NASCAR channel, but our goal is to get into interviews where we talk about 2.0 moments. For some people, it can be 3.0, 4.0, whatever it might be. But, you know, the notion of never settling, always trying to evolve, always trying to push yourself to that next experience or moment, and then the story in and around the transition.
It's cool. I was wondering where the name came from.
We're about to steal your ID when we talk to you.
Yeah, this works out great, I think.
We did steal the name from Marty's best-selling book called Never Settle. As we were trying to come up with a show name, I was like, dude, you're a best-selling author. Like, why don't we, you know, plagiarize your success and steal your success from your book and name our show? So it's worked out well.
I can't believe you didn't name it Seven Cups, though.
A little too on the nose.
Something we like to do on the show here when we talk to people such as yourself is kind of just get the full picture, start from the beginning of your career and just see how the story of Jimmy Johnson has played out so far. So if you don't mind, could we start from the beginning? Can we talk about how you got your start on dirt bikes, correct?
Correct.
You grew up in El Cajon, California. It makes sense that that would be a starting point for you growing up there. Let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, my grandparents owned a motorcycle store in El Cajon. Right. They had a little Kawasaki dealership. And as it turns out, when you look back through, I guess maybe the 60s, if not maybe the 50s, through the early 2000s, El Cajon was the hub for all national motocross championships.
Oh yeah.
And I just grew up in an area that had, you know, this scene going on, and all my heroes were motorcycle racers. My local track during my era of time, I remember being the fast kid at my local track, and we heard about this dude that raced BMX bikes that was going to come and try to show us what's up. And this kid named Jeremy McGrath showed up.
Oh my
and
God.
The gate dropped, and I'm the local champ at my track. And the gate dropped, and about three turns later, that guy was gone. Oh, and I was like, wow, pretty darn good. So, you know, I was very fortunate to grow up in the area. Brock Glover, Rick Johnson, Jeff Ward, Ron Lachine. You go back to the early days with like Marty Tripes, Marty Smith, which is now the company Thor, was called Hallman Racing, and that was based in San Diego. You just had this huge motocross culture and upbringing, and that was my start. And my dad ran the service department for the store. And on the weekends, we'd go to the local tracks. Eventually, my dad started running the tractor at the track, and we'd get the tracks ready, and my mom ran the snack bar. It was just a full family affair. That was our entry point to racing.
That's cool.
A great upbringing.
And then,
yeah, it was fun.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
You eventually made the jump to racing in Baja. Was there an in-between step? How did you continue on from racing the motorcycles to a truck like that? What was the in-between?
Honestly, my dad's love of motorsports was the glue and the in-between and really all of it. And then clearly my mom's support to allow me to race and my two younger brothers. But my dad's very mechanically inclined, and he had friends that raced in the stadium off-road racing series called the Mickey Thompson Off-Road Stadium Series. And through that, there were a lot of great connections made, one with the tire company, BF Goodrich Tires, which my dad eventually went to work for. But the scene and being around it and my dad's persistence to get me into a small little buggy in that series got me my four-wheeled start. I then was able to do some desert racing as well. And through the excitement as a 16, 17-year-old racing against these adults, I caught the eye of Chevrolet. And then that opened up more doors, and I started racing their off-road trucks for them.
Very cool. So those little buggies you're talking about, would that be the Super Light series?
Correct. Looks a lot like a Honda Odyssey or Honda Pilot, for those that remember those little buggies.
I thought you meant the minivan.
Not the minivan. No, they took the name from the go-kart and then put it on the minivan. Yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
How was your experience racing down in Baja?
Baja was interesting. I truly love Baja. I had many, many great experiences down there until 1995. I had one bad experience and I haven't been back since. But you know, Baja is a beautiful place. There's plenty of danger. And certainly in the 90s, when you had a bad crash, we didn't have GPS and all these elements being able to track down the vehicle, and somebody was injured, how to get them out quickly for help. And I had a really bad wreck. Thankfully, no one was injured badly, but it took almost a day for me to get to civilization. And oh after that God. Experience and being stranded, I have not been back down to race in Baja.
Were you solo racing, or did you have a co-pilot?
I had a co-pilot, but he fell asleep.
Oh, no.
And then I fell asleep.
Oh, God.
I was trying to solo the 1000. So this was 95, the first year of the trophy truck category. And I think it was like 18 or 19 years old. Chevrolet throws me the keys to this incredible vehicle. Like, man, if Ivan Stewart and Walker Evans can go solo in the Baja 1000, those guys are old. I got it. Like, no problem.
Right.
And my co-rider kept dozing off. And I want to blame him because I certainly don't want to blame myself. But eventually I dozed off. It wasn't for long, but long enough to miss a turn and go off the road at a high rate of speed and crash out through the darkness.
So were you injured and you had to just kind of like limp your way back to the nearest road, or what happened?
No, the vehicle was basically a total loss. I mean, we flipped end over end, ripped every corner off the vehicle. My landed on some big boulders and it smashed the roll cage down on my side and pinned me in the truck. And my co-rider was knocked unconscious. And the wheezing and the sounds he made when we finally came to a stop, I mean, I thought he had internal bleeding and broken ribs and stuff. But he ended up waking up and I climbed out. We climbed out and we just sat and waited.
Wow.
We were there forever. Wow. But you know, you had these race vehicles coming down the course. We'd stop them. But the next pit stop was, I don't know, 45 minutes to an hour from where we crashed. And each driver that we stopped said they would tell the pit after us where we were.
Uh-huh.
Guess they all forgot.
No.
Nobody came. We were just waiting and waiting. And the team has vehicles that are called chase vehicles. And these vehicles leapfrog the race car going down the peninsula. Ours was, I have a teammate, and he's one of the vehicles we stop and he continues on. The team thought that my chase vehicle was right behind and going to assist us. The problem is my chase vehicle got into a fender bender in a small town. And in Mexico, if you have any altercation like that, you're guilty until proven innocent. So they took my two crew members and threw them in a jail cell, ended up shaking them down for all their money, all their soft drinks, all the food, stickers.
They took their sodas?
Everything.
This is also when we're like, well, what happened? Why didn't you do that again? This is no kidding. Like, no wonder you switched from Baja. Yeah. Good Lord.
The other seven or eight trips I had down there for the 1000, in addition to being a kid and working pits with my dad, there were three races a year. You have a 250 mile race in San Felipe, a 500-mile race, and then the Baja 1000. And I had all these great experiences, 20-plus amazing experiences, but you have one bad one, and you're like, man, I'm good.
So, yeah, let's chart that out. You have that incident in Baja, and then do you move immediately to oval racing, or what was the next step after that?
You guys familiar with the NASCAR truck racing division that races on Fridays?
Yep.
So that series was founded, I think, in like 95. NASCAR came out with it. And before 95, the only way the manufacturers would market pickup trucks was with off-road truck racing. And in 95, we had this competition for the space and the dollars that go with it. Sadly, the off-road industry really suffered as a result, because it's tough to televise the Baja 1000 and all these other events. But a NASCAR truck race, it's quite easy. And we got news towards the end of the 95 season, right before the 1000, that Chevrolet was going to redirect its funding to NASCAR and the truck series. And so I knew my ride on the West Coast was drying up. The stadium racing and the desert racing was going away. And the next year, I was able to do some television work for Chevrolet in a off-road division they were still supporting in the Midwest. And in that experience, I met these two owners, these two brothers that owned an off-road team, and they had a dream and goal to move into NASCAR and have a Cup Series team. And their names were Stan and Randy Herzog. And that was the next transition for me. It took a little time to get the deal put together, but I raced for them a little bit in the Midwest in off-road. They then started a stock car racing program in a series called the ASA Series. And I ran that for a few years. And then they built a Xfinity team for me. And while I was driving their Xfinity car in 2001, I got the opportunity with Hendrick Motorsports to move into the Cup Series for 2002. And so that's kind of the evolution of things and being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And the fact that the timing lined up like that, preparation meets opportunities.
Very much so. I also have to say, you know, the Herzogs sadly aren't with us anymore. Both unfortunately passed away a little before their time just due to some health issues. But their passion for racing and their belief in me was just an incredible thing. They had every intention to move into NASCAR Cup racing with me. But when they saw an opportunity for me to go to Hendrick, they didn't want to stand in the way and keep me from having that opportunity. And I went to them one day and said, this is what I have. What should I do? I'm like, well, it's pretty easy. You need to take that. You need to go drive for Jeff Gordon and Rick Hendrick. And to have their support and understanding in that moment, still today, I can't thank them enough. And sadly, they moved on, or they continued on for maybe another 16, 18 months before they shut the team down. And, you know, they ran out of sponsorship. And with me not being there, it was tough to find the sponsors. And they went back to doing some off-road racing and some other forms of motorsports.
So to get the attention of Jeff Gordon and Rick Hendrick, you must have been doing pretty good in this lower level to get the Cup seat.
There were two moments, and the old saying that any press is good press applies to the first. Have you seen my brake failure in 2000 at Watkins Glen where I smashed into the wall? Mm-hmm. I have this crash. It's the only time in my life that while I was crashing, I was convinced I was dead.
Oh, wow.
And so I smash into this barrier, and it turns out to be a foam block, and this foam goes flying everywhere. And really spectacular crash. And when I climbed out of the car, I was so happy to be alive that I stood on top of the car and put my hands above my head. Yeah. Jeff Gordon and Rick Hendrick were watching. And they're like, oh, yeah, the guy's still alive. That's how they figured out my name. And then they thought it was funny that I got out celebrating like that. Which then led to an opportunity later in the year when I was racing against Jeff in the Xfinity Series. And I passed him on the last lap for like a top five. And those two moments spoke to him in a way that he's like, look, you know, we want to give you a shot. And I got the call.
After that thought goes through your head, we've talked to a lot of racers who have a moment of, should I do this anymore? Was that something that you asked yourself, or were you just like, just so glad to be out of the car and up that you were able to kind of power on without dealing with those?
In that instance, no, it didn't faze me one bit. And I've always been really aware of my headspace. And I've firmly believed in when you're out there driving in a way to protect yourself, that's typically when you get hurt. And there were enough stories when I was a young kid growing up racing and dreaming of being in the, you know, bigger forms of motorsports. It's really dangerous. And you would hear these drivers talking about it. You would see these deaths and injuries. And I just made a deal with myself that if I was ever fearful and drove differently, that I had to get out of the race car. And so in that moment, and still today, getting in the car, like I don't think that way, right or wrong. In those moments of those major crashes, it's always been a natural headspace to say, well, that's pretty fun. That was pretty cool. Like I'm fine. Yes. I'm good. Yeah. Dust myself off and go again.
So you're not disassociating at all. You're not trying to like put it out of your mind. You're fully embracing the danger of it and just moving forward regardless with that danger in mind.
Yes. We lost Dale Earnhardt in 2001. And I would say by 03, maybe 04, every track had been updated with the new current wall structure and safety regulations. And prior to that, this head and neck device and the seat to contain the driver had evolved. And now today, you know, this is one big help that I have to still get back in the car today. I don't have any concerns. I mean, sure, you can break a bone. Sure, you can be knocked out. But the safety threshold is at such a different level now.
I was just at the Cup race this weekend in Texas, and looking inside those cars, that the head protection on those seats, I mean, it is no joke, like a foot of foam on each side of the head. It's pretty amazing how safe, at least how safe they look and how safe they are. I mean, we saw plenty of wrecks this weekend, and everyone was A-okay.
Yeah, they've really raised the threshold. You know, they estimate that Dale Sr.'s impact was a 90G impact that tragically took his life. And we have drivers well over a 60G impact now, not losing consciousness. You know, the vehicle, crazy. The wall system, a lot of it had to be mandated. There was a point in time where any and all series were afraid to mandate certain technical aspects. And ironically, the rule book would read, helmet suggested, fire retardant clothing suggested, seatbelts suggested. Nobody wanted to be liable. And following Dale's death, there were four others in a calendar year, so five in total, all from the same fatal injury. And after the loss of Dale, every manufacturer, auto manufacturer, every professional form of motorsports band together and created a wall system, the cockpit, and then the head and neck device, all together in a big collaboration amongst everyone. And it's completely changed the sport.
It's a good thing to come out of it. Such a horrible situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
So I want to talk about your five-time championship run there. Just an amazing accomplishment. I was reviewing a Jimmy Johnson career highlight reel that NASCAR put together a couple of years ago. Just a really fun watch. But specifically, though, I want to talk about your mindset and the mindset of your team during that time. What were the most important factors that allowed your team to execute at that level for so long?
I would say the struggles that we had in 2004 and 2005 really set us up for that five-year run. My rookie year was in 2002, so it might sound a little funny to say that we struggled and had these really powerful learning moments, but you know, I led the points in my rookie season in 2002. 2003, we were really competitive, but then 2004, I lost the championship, and this was the old NASCAR Winston Cup schedule at that point. I lost the championship by one position on track after 36 championship points races, by one spot. And so that stung. And then in actually, it was the first year of the Sprint Cup, so I'm incorrect. How did that work out? No, that was still the old system. Anyhow, it's been a while, but I know by one spot on track. And then the next year, I lost to Tony Stewart. We had an issue in the final race and blew a tire and hit the wall. And the inside of our team on the 48 car, especially between Chad Knaus and leadership and myself, we just had to evolve. And Chad had a system where he controlled every aspect of it. And the demands of the job were so intense and so great that it was limiting us. He was overstressed, and there was a lot of friction building within the team. And Mr. Hendrick sat Chad and I down, and we had this meeting that we called Milk and Cookies. Chad and I were arguing and yelling at each other, and there's a lot of infighting in the team, and we're acting like kids. And Rick had enough of it, and after the season was over, brought us into his big, beautiful conference room, had Chad and I sit down at the conference room table, and he went and he pulled out two Mickey Mouse plates, pulled out a box of cookies, a gallon of milk, and two red Solo cups. And you could see he was not in a great mood and was irritated at us both. Chad and I barely look at each other. And so he goes through this conversation with us about acting like kids and act like kids. I'm going to treat you like kids. And cookies end up on our plates, and he fills up our milk glasses and then forces us to eat the cookies and drink the milk. And he reprimands us like we're little grade school kids and acting like idiots. And it was so funny and uncomfortable at the same time that it broke down a variety of different barriers that Chad and I were dealing with. And then we sat there for a few hours after and had this big what if conversation. Like, well, what if we approached the other leaders within the team and empowered them more? What if, you know, this? What if that? And really put the framework together for the team we became. And we rolled into the 2006 season, won the Daytona 500, won the championship. Next year, win the championship. Next year, win the championship. And it just, we just started building on that moment.
Usually that's how you like reward a kid though, by giving them cookies.
That's fair. It still worked.
What is that mindset? How do you keep it? How do you keep it from being just like a one-off?
Yeah, I can see that being very powerful for one or two seasons. But then like after that point, maybe it becomes, you start taking the process for granted a little bit. How do you keep your eye on the ball?
I think as I reflect back, and of course, I'm a fan of all sports and see different runs that franchises can put on. And it's so hard. It's one thing to get there and then to keep it, you know, year after year is the hardest part. One unique element that we had is the 48 car was not at Hendrick Motorsports beforehand. And the team that Chad and I were able to put together, you had some guys like Chad had a chip on his shoulder because he felt there were a few things, a few other jobs that he was overlooked for, and he had something to prove. I was coming into the Cup Series at 25, which is like 5 years late compared to a lot of the guys I grew up racing against. So I had a chip on my shoulder. I had a couple other crew members in a similar space. And then we had a bunch of new guys that were just hungry and ready to go. And with that environment, we knew that we were, you know, building the foundation for this team. Our fingerprints were creating this team. And there was a bond and a focus that is just a rare and unique opportunity. And it was due to us starting a new team and a variety of guys with some experience, but had something to prove, and a bunch of young guys that had endless energy. And we just went on this run.
So you mentioned that you're a fan of all sports. Do you ever get the comparison of like Tom Brady and the Patriots? Cause it was kind of happening at the same time as your run.
Yeah. We saw it all the time, and been able to get to know Tom a little bit here in recent years. And it's interesting because on the Patriots side, you know, it was in the sports papers and sports channels enough to where they both saw it, and from their side looked at our success in the comparison with admiration, and we certainly did too.
Did you ever jerseys? Not jerseys, but like techniques, or like, hey, yeah, this is something we're doing over here and really works for us, and did you apply it to your team or vice versa? Do you know if it doesn't have to be with the Patriots or just any other successful team?
Yeah, through my fandom of watching sports and going to some University of Oklahoma football games, my wife went to OU. And when we first started dating, it was right at the end of their streak. They were still going to national championship games, but came out on the wrong side of that. But being in their locker room and being around and getting to know Coach Stoops a bit and the athletic director and, you know, a variety of different people there, I was so inspired by their locker room. Mm-hmm. And when those athletes would run out of the tunnel, there was a bond and an intensity that I thought our sport could use. And I worked really hard through my career to be that individual inside of our transporter, inside of our shop, inside of our little locker room of what the 48 car was about, and try to bring that out of my guys. And a lot of it had to do with building relationships with all of them. It's one thing to scream, yell, teach, lead in a way that, you know, you're maybe not living it, you're showing it to someone or instructing them to do it, but it's different when you're in the trenches living it with those individuals. And a crew chief is much like a head coach, but a crew chief in NASCAR has to run a budget. They have to manage not only the athletes that, you know, me as the athlete and our core group of engineers and mechanics go to the track, they also manage the athletes that pit the car. And so that the leader, the crew chief at NASCAR, it's almost like a general manager. And so there's some separation there that I could see and notice, especially in the system that I was in at Hendrick. And I thought, man, I need to be more of a head coach. You know, I not that I need to teach these guys what to do, but that mentor and the connection and the why to go to work, why to get up early, I need to make that about me. And that was one thing that I really leaned into. And when I look back at our team and our bond, man, those guys have run through a brick wall for me. And I really found that inspiration from college sports.
You are an athlete yourself. You've done triathlons and you've run marathons. at a pretty good pace too. You ran the Boston Marathon like a little over 3 hours, which is crazy.
Thank you.
I can't run 1 mile, but I'm, which is harder, doing like a 500 mile
that's a good
endurance
question.
Race or a 26 mile foot race?
Without a doubt, the hardest thing I've ever done is a marathon. The training, the day is tough, and I wanted to race it. I was trying to break 3 hours. And with that, my volume and training schedule was, you know, designed to fully race. And mind you, this was in the middle of our NASCAR season. And I had a NASCAR Cup race on Saturday night. I had to travel to Boston, try to recover and get hydrated, and then run the marathon on Monday. And I was a little disappointed with my time, but I was more fatigued for the marathon than I gave myself credit for, but still ran a great time. But the training and the two-a-days and the monotony of running and the pain of running that much, when I got down to my high volume weeks, I was 80 to 90 miles a week.
Oh my God.
And doing two-a-days at that kind of volume sucked.
Did you find that kind of training lent itself any insights into your wheel racing, car racing, as opposed to foot?
I did. I felt like triathlon was a really good space for me. In the headspace, nutrition, hydration, recovery, commitment, accountability, all of that was very, very similar. I swam in high school when growing up in California, played water polo and swam, and our water sports were much more popular than football and baseball where I grew up. So I've always been interested in tries, and I thought that swim, bike, run was just a really good full body training experience. And then the headspace, I found my training sessions would help me be organized, thinking about the right things. I found that I was largely always worried about my race car and came up with different setup ideas or different management ideas and how to approach my group. I don't know, it was just really good space for me. The running, the marathon itself, especially towards the end of getting ready for Boston, I spent more time cussing myself that I was doing it than really enjoying it.
Well, speaking of multi-sport, you left NASCAR and then you went to open wheel. Talk to us about, I guess, why, you know, and what that experience was like.
Growing up on the West Coast, we didn't have much NASCAR. And remember in the 80s, worldwide sports or something would come on. And you guys remember that?
Yeah.
You'd get like three or four different shows for small little tidbits. Yep. That was all I knew of NASCAR. That's all we got. And so moto, off-road, and IndyCar. That was on the West Coast. And Rick Mears, Roger Mears, Robbie Gordon all came from off-road racing and went to IndyCar. And if I wanted to have a professional career, that was kind of the road that was traveled in front of me. And I was committed to that path. And in my late teens, Chevrolet shared with me that they were going to pull out of open wheel racing. They didn't sell a car that looked like that. They didn't have an engine that fit the configuration. And if I wanted a career on the asphalt, I should move to North Carolina and consider NASCAR. And so after I had one of my meetings with the head of Chevrolet Racing, 2 weeks later, I bought a one-way ticket to Charlotte in 1997, basically been there ever since. And so with that journey and going through my Cup career, there's always something there that, you know, I wanted to go open wheel racing, give it a shot. I always wanted to do the double, wasn't able to put it together for a variety of reasons. And then had a conversation with Chip Ganassi in my final season of NASCAR. It's like, man, just come hang out for a year or two, three, four, whatever it is, just come have some fun. And I was able to get connected with Carvana, and I had two really fun years of chasing my childhood dream of being an open wheel driver.
What were the biggest differences between driving a stock car and driving the IndyCar chassis?
Yeah, IndyCar, you know, all the grips created by the airspeed, so vehicle speed, airspeed. And in a NASCAR vehicle, you quickly hit a point of diminishing returns with vehicle speed, and you slide the car around. It was tough for me in the Indy car to realize that after I almost crashed, that if I just went a little faster, it would get better. Huh.
That's yeah. a crazy.
And so that was an interesting process to get used to. And I got better. A third year, I think I would have done far better yet, but I had accomplished what I wanted to and I was ready for a new challenge.
Was there a moment when you were in the IndyCar where you maybe thought, what did I get myself into with this?
Yeah, there were many times, especially at 250 miles an hour at Indy and qualifying. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? I have to say one major sense of release for me in IndyCar was finally crashing one and realizing that, you know, they do have some crumple zones and absorb the impact. I was really afraid of, you know, 230 mile an hour crash in one of those cars. And surprisingly, they dissipate the crash energy pretty well.
I forget whose wreck it was, either last year or the year before at the 500. I mean, the car just like, it looked like it exploded. Of course, no flames or anything like that. But yeah, all that energy dissipating into just bits of carbon fiber and who knows what else. I don't. But yeah, they're pretty amazing machines. You mentioned after the IndyCar, you know, moving on to other things. I assume you're talking about the Garage 56 Le Mans experience.
Yes, that was... I did some sports car racing throughout my Cup career. Yeah, I did probably nine or 10 Rolex 24-hour events. Finished on the podium in 21 and 22 when I was doing the IndyCar series. I also did compete in some U.S.-based sports car racing, but all along trying to get to Le Mans. You know, I've really been on a quest to hunt these marquee events down and try to participate in them. And gosh, what an amazing experience and perfect opportunity. Go back with Hendrick, Chevrolet, all of NASCAR, share a vehicle with Jensen Button and Mike Rockenfeller. We had a great experience doing that.
I was pretty psyched when that was announced, just for the record. Yeah. I think that's such a cool project and how amazing to have been a part of that.
The reception we had over there, I wish more American motorsports enthusiasts could sense and understand the respect that all the fans, international fans, but largely French fans, had for that vehicle and for our efforts over there. It was a very proud moment. The in most other sports, you have some type of international experience, Olympics, whatever it might be, and for racing, we don't have that. So it was really my first opportunity to sense some international excitement and interest and feel like I was representing our country abroad, and it was really an amazing experience.
And I believe there's a documentary about that coming out on Prime pretty soon. Were you pretty involved in that as well?
I was. In fact, we just recorded an hour, I think, after the docuplays. There's an hour with Jeff Gordon, myself.
Oh, cool.
Chad Knaus and the head of IMSA, head of Goodyear, head of GM, talking about the experience and some more behind the scenes stuff. And we just filmed that maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I know the docu is going to hit soon, including this hour special.
So Knaus joined you guys over there as well.
He did.
That's very cool. Okay. You said you want to chase down some marquee events. What else is on your bucket list there? What else does Jimmy Johnson want to drive?
I want to race at Monaco in something. I don't know how to quite pull that off, especially at 49 and the only thing that races there are Formula cars. And you look at Formula One, there's no chance. And then the junior divisions there, you know, there are a lot of 16 and 18-year-old kids in those cars. So I don't know if that's going to happen. But you know, they do have a classic car race there that I could maybe go and experience.
Oh, that would be amazing.
So you'd never like shave your beard and pretend to be a 16-year-old to get into one of these classes?
I would certainly try. Unfortunately, they want to see your license at some point.
Have you ever had the chance to drive a Formula One car?
I did in 2018. I did a car swap with Alonso.
Oh, that's really fun.
Yeah, we sent over a cup car to the Bahrain circuit, and they brought over a Formula One car, and we did the swap. And what a wild day that was.
Between the Formula One car and the Indy car, did you notice like a big difference between those two?
Yeah, and it depends on the rules, different generations and times of cars. You know, I think the vehicles out there now, with a big tire, Formula One car, that is a pretty high level of performance. The vehicle I was in didn't have the big tire, but it had a lot of ground effects, and the exhaust was incorporated into the
and a blown diffuser.
Downforce the way it created a blown diffuser. So it was really a fun car to drive. Took a lot of commitment. The biggest thing that impressed me was the braking. And I went out and shook the car down for Fernando while he took the Formula One car out for me. And on the front straightaway at Bahrain, the braking marker started at the 300 board. And so I had to find a physical braking mark that would be about the 600, because at 200 miles an hour in a cup car, you got to hit the brakes about six, just the way it is. And so I found a physical reference there on part of the grandstands. And when we went to swap cars, he asked me, you know, where the brake mark was. I said, man, it's where a 600 marker would be. And he's like, no way. I'm like, I'm telling you, man, like, do not go to the three. Like, there's no chance. There's no way. Like, I'm telling you why. I mean, what's it in the Formula One car? He goes, the 50. I'm like, why 050? Yeah. He's like, yeah, the 50. I'm like, holy shit.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow. So just the physical weight is enough to, like, I mean, the brakes are stronger, but the weight of the car, two cars, is crazy.
Weight and then the downforce perspective. Horsepower was quite similar, and top speed in those vehicles, ironically, are very similar, but braking and cornering, they're just two different games.
Because this was not the next gen car at that time. This was the previous chassis.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did love it when he got out of my car after a couple outings. He came over and he's kind of giggling. What's up? I said, are you supposed to spin the rear tires in every gear? I said, yes, welcome to NASCAR.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That's
super cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I have a question. I saw that you have a charitable organization that works with supporting education from K through 12. Will you tell us a little bit about that and what kind of programs are related, and if anybody wants to get involved, how they'd find out about it?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. JimmyJohnsonFoundation.org is how you learn more about what we're focused on. And during my career, I was very fortunate to have sponsors that did a lot in the charity space and wanted to support causes that were focused for myself and for my family. And my wife grew up in Oklahoma. I grew up in Southern California. We're obviously residing in North Carolina. My mom was a school bus driver, and my wife's mom spent a lot of time working for schools and the school system and such. And we wanted to support public education. And my wife and I are both products of public education and understand the gaps that exist there and the challenges that schools have. And we've raised money, I think around $14 million now, that we've been able to give back to my hometown, my wife's hometown, and then where we live in North Carolina. And it's been a lot of fun. We're trying to figure out how we can do more, and maybe expand into some other areas. Those three areas, we feel really good about what we've done. And it's just amazing to watch kids that we meet at one point in time when we're donating a STEM research lab, and we still stay in touch with the schools and these students that come and participate. And we have kids off in college now pursuing careers because of the experience and influence they had through the foundation at their local grade school.
That's so cool.
That's very admirable. Very cool.
Did you grow up wrenching on cars? And if so, what was your first car that you worked on?
I worked on my motorcycles a lot growing up. I had a go-kart that I maintenance and took care of. But one of my early jobs, I worked in a shop company as a in the shipping area, taping boxes together. That wasn't all that mechanical or glorious, but had that job. Cool thing about that job is I was able to buy my first jet ski. So, Southern California, water sports. But the next job, I worked in an off-road engine facility. And I really wasn't trusted to put anything together. But after the races, we'd have all these engines that we'd have to clean, break down, rebuild. And man, I wore them down, spent a lot of time in a solvent tank. Yeah. Spent a lot of time in a bead blasting booth, all these different things, trying to get the parts and pieces prepped and ready for the guys to put the engines back together.
So can you do a backflip on your jet ski?
No, it's wild. Is even when I raced moto, like a little no-hander or, a knack-knack was huge when McGrath started that late 90s. And now if you do a knack-knack, you'll get laughed out of the place. So backflip, if not, 2 to 3 backflips are required. It's funny how much it's changed.
Yeah, they got Colby Raha jumping off of dams now and stuff. It's crazy. All right.
Wild. All right, but I do have one last question. Just
I love these guys, but sometimes they can annoy me. You and Marty, you've been working together now. What's a quirk? Is there anything that could get under your skin with him? What really gets your goat?
Gets my goat. One thing that I laugh and I try to walk him into these opportunities all the time. He has such a thick Southern draw, and to have him try to say certain words or speak in French. He went with me one time to an event that I was racing in Paris, and to hear him try to say thank you in French with that Southern draw.
Merci.
Merci. Bacap. All right. No, I like that. We'll be listening for that on your podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Please go check out Never Settle by Jimmy Johnson and Marty Smith. You can find it on Sirius XM. Jimmy, thank you so much for coming on the show, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it, guys. All great the best. To meet you. Come see us at a race.
All right.
Absolutely. Hell yeah. That is our show. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you once again to Jimmy Johnson for coming on. Really great conversation. That was a lot of fun. I think some stuff you can take from his racing career and apply it to maybe your own life, I think, a little bit. Some lessons there. Give us a like and a follow and a review on the platform of your choice. And you can check out our other podcast, Past Gas. It's a history show. This week, we're talking about Nigel Mansell. That was a fun one.
Mm-hmm. That was a really fun one. Yeah,
so go check that out. He's a really cool guy. Great mustache, too.
Dude, he had a 12-inch chunk of flesh.
Oh, yeah.
Just came out of his body during a race.
Yeah.
And then he was back like 3 weeks later.
He was banged up. That's right. This man, Nigel Mansell, took an enormous amount of...
multiple broken necks and broken backs. Yeah.
Crazy story. So check that out on Past Gas. That was a really fun one. Follow us at Donut Podcasts on Instagram and our personal accounts. You got Bids Bardo. And you got Joji Weber and Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to the crew, Mark, Audrey, and Edgar. On the camera there. All right. Bye.
All right.